Good morning, Judge Verellin, and good morning to the court. Oliver Davis for Mr. Eimer. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, if I could. This is Mr. Eimer's appeal from a conviction for second-degree rape. And I'm asking the court to find that the trial court abused its discretion when it denied defense counsel Don Miner's a request for an order for the discovery and production of the complainant AP's mental health history records, and in particular her drug abuse records. Mr. Eimer unquestionably has a right to discovery in a criminal case under Rule 4.7. This is something beyond a request for mere discovery. The general standard for discovery is that a request must be reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of relevant evidence. We're dealing here with drug abuse, treatment records, medical records, counseling records, with records that are unquestionably privileged by statute. And in that situation, Mr. Eimer's due process right to discovery of information that may be material to his defense is governed by the United States Supreme Court's decision in Ritchie, and of course this court's and the Supreme Court's decisions in Gregory and Kalikoski, which establish a higher standard for discovery of privileged records. And that is that
Does the trial court have the discretion to look at a fact pattern like this and say, I don't think you can make the concrete connection required to get to these privileged documents absent some expert testimony, a declaration, a book, something that links up, confirms this statement by the victim that there's some connection between PTSD or borderline personality disorder and memory problems?
Well, there isn't any requirement that an expert witness be provided for purpose of the discovery request. Mr. Miner provided what I believe he's required to provide, which is a motion accompanied by an affidavit stating why he believed there's a fact-based reason to show that the counseling records and the drug treatment records contain evidence that's material to the defense. And the concrete connection Your Honor is asking about is part of the higher standard that's required when privileged records are sought.
I guess I'm trying to get to, how does discretion come into play? Does the court have discretion to say, okay, let's go do it, let's look at those, or say, no, I want something that firms up this connection before we just sail off into an in-camera review?
I think the question for the court and for purposes of exercising its discretion should be whether the showing that a defense counsel has made in his motion and in his affidavit, which in this case was quite careful to set out his theories of materiality with reference to particular parts of the discovery, including the interviews that I'll discuss. I think the court's exercise of its discretion should be based on the showing that's made and determine whether that showing is adequate. To suggest that some additional expert affidavit is required in order to necessarily make that showing does not seem to me to be part of the rule. And that was one of the arguments that counsel for AP made at the pretrial hearing, is that you haven't provided some expert who's going to say that what you've stated in your affidavit, in my expert opinion, shows that this person must have a mental disorder. And I don't believe that there's any requirement that Mr. Miner was required to do that.
The court's discretion. I mean, does the court have discretion to say, I want to have that?
The court has discretion to say what you've provided is not enough. And our argument is that this was an abuse of discretion because Mr. Miner provided a motion and an affidavit that unquestionably made and met the requirement of a fact-based showing that the records would contain material evidence.
If the court abused its discretion, what is the standard to determine whether or not it's reversible error? Because the victim herself, when she testified, was quite forthright about her drug use, about her memory issues, about her consumption of alcohol. And I know it's a somewhat different issue on restricting cross-examination, but it seemed to me the only thing the trial judge said is you can't cross-examine her about post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, and that was just sort of the second issue, is that ultimately after this discovery of her mental health records and drug counseling records was precluded, that defense counsel was also not asked, entitled or allowed to ask every question that he wanted to ask, in particular about her statements that she had PTSD. Now, my argument there is essentially, I'm trying to point out to the court that, of course, Mr. Minor was unable to make a specific connection between her PTSD and memory problems because he'd been denied the ability prior to trial to discover those records. And the court's ruling pretrial was essentially what you've stated here factually, your theory that these records may be material, I find to be inadequate, and essentially adopted Ms. Cordo's, Ms. AP's attorney's argument. This was essentially a frivolous motion, and I think that if we looked at what was before Mr. Minor when he prepared this motion and affidavit, it's quite clear that this information did meet the materiality standard.
Well, let's for the sake of analyzing the discovery issue, let's take the cross-examination issue out of it. How does an appellate court decide whether or not the failure to produce a record is in fact error? Well, just that it might somehow have impeachment value, or how speculative is that?
Judge Reland mentioned the concept of, for discovery purposes, of counsel making a concrete connection between the records that are sought, and I believe this court has expressed a connection between the records and the theory of the case. Now, if one looks at trial, a great part of the defense was their presentment of a witness, Dr. Julian, who made a number of important statements, or attempted to, about the connection between drug use and the ability to perceive, which he stated could be something that would be affected by heroin use and methamphetamine use. These could cause a person to have a difficult ability to perceive events. He also stated, and this was important because it went to the overall history of drug treatment that was not allowed to be discovered. Dr. Julian stated that if a person is going through a withdrawal phase as part of a long-term addiction, that person, in fact, could have hallucinations, which was incredibly important to the defense, at least a part of the defense argument, which is that this individual simply was not perceiving things correctly. And to continue on that question of a harmless error, the prosecutor pointed out, well, you've reviewed this individual's medical records from when she went to the hospital after the alleged crime, and pointed out several times that this was simply a review of, Dr. Julian had simply reviewed what was in those records in terms of the drugs in her blood at that time. But she, Ms. AP admits to the existence of records in Montana, and the existence of drug treatment records had to do with her abuse over time, and those were particularly relevant. In addition to the mental health records, she admitted PTSD, but refused to sign a release for those records.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Siever. I'm here on behalf of the state of Washington. I don't want to concede off the top that there are even mental health records that exist. We simply don't know at this point. But even if there are somewhere out there some records that AP did seek mental health treatment, the threshold rule in Kalikoski still serves two important purposes that weren't met here. First, the Kalikoski rule protects patients because people should be allowed to seek mental health care without worrying about down the course of the road that their treatment will somehow become exposed. It's common sense that confidentiality is key to successful treatment, particularly, I would think, in the context of mental health. And second, that rule protects witnesses. We don't want people, generally speaking, who've gone through horrible experiences like AP did in this case, being raped by a group of men in a motel room with a plastic vodka bottle, from being victimized again simply because they reported being assaulted and sought help. Whatever value Mr. Minor or a defense attorney might seek from a rape victim's privileged records, this kind of motion to have an in-camera review and require a victim to put forth medical records, that, you know, it has an intimidation factor. It has a humiliation factor on victims.
Why isn't this like Gregory, where there is a concrete connection, even though those same policies are present?
Certainly.
You're entitled to get them to put on your defense. Why doesn't it apply here?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. The state's not saying that the Gregory decision was decided incorrectly, just that here the showing that was made, unlike in State versus Gregory, was insufficient. In Gregory, we were talking about dependency records. It was a woman who reported being raped. The defense was that she was a prostitute who was engaged in this as a line of business, that she was a drug addict, and that it was a consensual encounter insofar as a prostitution relationship can be, that she was doing to support her drug habit. At the same time that the crime was occurring in Gregory, the complainant was a subject of a number of dependency proceedings. Her children were being taken away from her because the state had been alleging in the dependency action that she was a prostitute who was engaged in all kinds of illicit activity and was a drug addict, and that those dependency records would likely contain evidence that was material to the defense. Here, what we had was, at the time the motion was initially presented, the defense attorney brought forth three things in support of it. One, that mental health records must exist because the victim was very upset while she was being raped and when she was found by police officers in the parking lot outside the motel room. Two, that she told the staff at Harborview when she was transported there immediately after the attack that she had no mental health history that she was aware of. Three, that she declined to answer in a defense interview whether she had a history of mental health problems. That was all that was presented. No indication that any records existed. No indication that those records would contain information that would be useful to the defense. When Mr. Miner sought reconsideration of the trial court's original ruling, he said, oh, one more thing. I noticed in a police interview, a very lengthy police interview of the victim, she was asked to describe the color of a mixed drink she'd been served prior to the rape. It was a pretty extraneous detail. And she said, you know, I can't remember that. Sometimes I have memory problems due to anxiety, drug use, borderline, PTSD.
Borderline personality disorder, PTSD.
Exactly.
So if she had said in that interview, my recent borderline personality disorder and my recent PTSD, would that align it with Gregory, where we have recent records of prostitution activity?
The thing is, Your Honor, we don't know what that even meant. People self-diagnose all the time based on something they saw on TV, something they read in a magazine. We don't know if she ever actually sought any mental health treatment or if this was just something that she came up with herself. Your Honor asked opposing counsel earlier, doesn't the trial court have some discretion to ask, well, what about borderline and PTSD? Do those even affect a witness's ability to recall events, anything that would affect their credibility? And defense counsel said, you know, basically, I don't know. And the trial court said, well, if you can find something and bring that back to me, I'll reconsider my ruling.
Was the police report a late-breaking development, or was it available to defense counsel when the defense interview occurred and she was asked directly about her whether she had mental health records?
That's a good point. I should have pointed that out in my briefing, Your Honor. It existed long before, I believe, the defense interview took place. It may have just been something that he'd overlooked, and I think that was the case. And there was no pursuit of it. And there was no pursuit of the idea that, you know, and I think that the trial court made an interesting point, saying that he knew a number of people who had borderline personality disorder and had never noticed any problem in their ability to recall. And the trial court invited defense counsel, show me something that says PTSD can affect a witness's ability to recall. The trial court allowed the defense attorney to cross-examine AP about her drug use, which was significant, and the cross-examination did take place. Whether he pursued the anxiety angle, I don't think there's much to support the idea that anxiety does affect somebody's memory. And again, this was just on this one minor detail. So to return to the Kalikowski test, you have to, a defense attorney, to obtain privileged records, has to show with particularity that those records will contain information that will likely contain information that is useful to the defense. The only thing that came up here was that she could not describe a particular drink, the color of that particular drink she was given. There's nothing else in that interview that defense counsel pointed out, said, see, this is indicative of a mental health disorder.
I thought I heard a remark about there were mental health records in Montana or something, but you said no, there aren't any. You're not even sure there are any?
I don't believe there are, Your Honor.
Where does that come from?
I don't know off the top. I was when I heard that, I may be mistaken, but I don't recall that. I'm sure Mr. Davis may be able to point to something in the record, but I don't believe that presentation was made, at least during the hearings on this particular subject, which were at the inception of the trial and before jury selection took place.
What was the significance of Dr. Julian's testimony?
It was primarily, Your Honor, and thank you for reminding me. The one thing I would like to note before answering the court's question is the substance abuse treatment that AP undertook was after arrests were made, after this charged event took place. AP readily acknowledged that she was a pretty habitual drug user at the time that these events took place, and that she'd ingested things even in that motel room that day. Dr. Julian's testimony was primarily twofold. One, that drugs can have an effect on somebody's ability to perceive what took place. And two, that somebody who's in the throes of addiction will do anything they can to obtain drugs and become kind of monomaniacally focused. And it fit into the defense theory of the case that AP here was participating consensually, and that any trauma she was reporting was due to the fact that she was basically suffering withdrawal symptoms as opposed to having been victimized. That was what Dr. Julian's testimony primarily concerned, just the effect of drugs on a person. With regard to the question of the scope of cross-examination and whether it was unfairly limited, I just say again, Your Honors, that there was no evidence presented to the trial court that would justify the trial court in concluding that borderline personality disorder and PTSD affect a person's ability to recall. Absent that, it would have been irrelevant and certainly unfairly prejudicial to AP to be asked about those things. The jury would have undoubtedly been confused by them, and it would have had a pretty harmful effect on her ability to participate in this proceeding. With regard to the recording of the calls, I just rest on my brief. If the court has no further questions, I just ask that the defendant's convictions for second-degree rape and indecent liberties be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
So just first to answer your question, Judge Becker, the August 1st, 2013 interview is the interview in which which AP stated twice that there were drug treatment records, including in Montana. She later indicated that she was taking Suboxone, a medication, as a result of that drug treatment in Montana. In the August 2013 interview, she stated she didn't have any condition.
Is that the police interview or the defense?
I'm referring now to the defense interview in August of 2013. Now, it's absolutely correct that it wasn't until Mr. Minor asked for reconsideration of the discovery ruling that he pointed out that in the police interview, AP had stated that she has borderline personality disorder, PTSD, and that it causes her to have memory problems, and that her drug abuse causes her to have memory problems. And Mr. Minor was quite candid with the court that he wished this is something that he had noticed earlier when he made the earlier motion. And he properly asked for reconsideration of the discovery motion, and that was denied. But at the time of the first motion, there was abundant evidence in what was presented to the court that she had mental health records. She stated she would not sign any release for her mental health records. When she was asked about her drug abuse records and how much she used, she said, "I'm not going to answer that. That's not relevant. I won't answer." She stated when she refused to release her medical records that she actually did go to treatment in May. So she's admitting that she does have records, but she won't release them. And this, the default that the respondent has assigned to this case in the briefing is, well, you haven't been able to specify the precise provider. But of course, if production is required, Ms. AP could be required to state who the provider was. It was not Mr. Minor's intent to intimidate an average rape victim from bringing a case. He made the special showing that was necessary for discovery of privileged materials.
Thank you. Thank you both. Next up is Otey versus Group Health.